Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I am your host, Dr. Samantha Cooper, and each episode presents my conversations with musicologists, ethnomusicologists, and sound study scholars who specialize in the music and sound of Jewish experience. I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to today's episode featuring Dr. Jeremiah Lockwood. So, Jeremiah, welcome to the Sounding Jewish podcast.
Thank you so much, Samantha. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you for joining me. I'd love to give you the chance to introduce yourself.
My name is Jeremiah Lockwood. I'm a scholar and a musician, and a lot of my work has to do with early 20th century cantorial music and the expressive culture of the Yiddish immigrant community in the United States in the early 20th century.
Can you tell me about one of your earliest encounters with Jewish sound or music and why this was such a formative experience for you?
Sure. I grew up in a cantorial family, and so there was not a time when I wasn't involved in Jewish music, so to speak. A formative experience was, aside from the music that my family made, was listening to old records with my grandfather, who was a great listener as well as being a great singer, musician. And he loved sitting in silence, listening to old records, to old cantorial records specifically. And so that was very educational to me, not just in what the music was about, but in how to feel the music, how to respond to it, and listening to records as being a spiritual practice and as a life-giving part of human experience.
When you say you were raised in a cantorial family, what do you mean by that?
My grandfather was a cantor, and he was a very kind of revered figure in the family. He was a well-known cantor, and he was a very great vocal artist. His uncle was Jacob Lefkowitz, who was a well-known cantor and composer. And his first cousin was David Lefkowitz, who was a cantor at the Park Avenue Synagogue. Uncle Josh, cantor at a major synagogue in the New Haven great metropolitan area. My cousin Zachary is a cantor. So it's intergenerational and, you know, just a major subject of conversation and thought, and not just cantor music. My dad's a composer as well, has written a bunch of music for my uncle and my grandfather. So it was very much family business and preoccupation and
Yeah, the cantorate is the family business. That's a new one, but I like it.
Oh, it's, I think that's quite normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny because in my own research, I've come across that story many times with the opera singers in terms of having cantorial lineage coming from multiple sides of the family. But recently, I haven't heard a story like that. So it seems very fascinating to me that you are the product of this.
It's a little old school. The normative story about the Jewish community in the 20th century is that people would go into other professions, you know, and they would not leave traditional Jewish professions and become doctors or, you know, to do something that makes more money, basically. My family is a little retrograde.
Nice. I like it. What would you say were the kinds of personal or musical experiences that motivated you to want to study Jewish music?
Well, again, I mean, there are a few different ways I could answer that. One has to do with my music making career. I began playing music professionally very young. I started to like 13, 14 years old, to working. I played the guitar. I loved old blues music. Playing in the street and in nightclubs from a very early age. And I met a wonderful blues musician named Carolina Slim, who I played with a lot. You know, I used to play with him all the time when I was growing up.
You love, you Lord, remember me. You love, you love, you Lord.
There were other blues musicians in the city as well. It was kind of a scene of elder blues musicians who were born in the South and in the early 20th century and part of the Great Migration lived in New York City. And so there was a lot of music in that area.
Going up, going down, up, down, baby. Any way you walk, let it roll. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You got me doing what you want. What you want me to do.
And so that was my first music community outside of the family. And I'm still involved in that music making community. But in terms of my music that I wanted to make, it took me a while to figure out how to do it, but I wanted to bring my family's music lineage into my work as a songwriter. And again, it took time for me to figure out how to do that. But it was something that I was actively pursuing and trying to do from a very early age. I sort of turned towards becoming academic after I'd already been working professionally as a musician for a very long time. It's a second career for me, but it's not exactly a second career because it's so bound up with my musical life before as well, or concurrently. I don't know. It's multiple streams that are flowing into each other.
Definitely.
So I went back to school, did a PhD, and wrote my thesis about young cantors in the Hasidic community. That's been a big turn in my life because I think a lot of my thoughts about Jewish music, especially about cantorial music, was very retrospectively oriented about my grandfather's generation. And I thought I would write about that era in Jewish American music.
Ve yulu lamur roim ve
And then I got involved with younger singers, people who are younger than me, who are similarly kind of obsessed with early cantorial records and looking at practice of prayer as an art experience.
V'hizikir es Hashem b'silodiyem v'yubul l'amorim v'yubul l'amorim v'shuvarim.
Everybody says that they're doing that, right? I mean, that's the normal line about what is happening in prayer leading. But the cantorial version of that story is inflected a bit differently, because really the music has taken on a life of its own outside of the synagogue. And in some ways it's stronger, more alive in non-institutional spaces. And that's been true for a long time, since at least the turn of the 20th century. So this kind of dialectic of aesthetics and sacred experience and kind of the maven and nonconformist artist experience and the liturgical spiritual leader in the community, this is a place of pleasing contention, and a lot of questions arise from it. And even I started feeling like I knew a lot more about cantorial music than I feel like I know now. The questions just start to pile up once you look at the lives of the greatest artists and the uses and deformations of the idea of tradition that arise, the political elements of the lives of cantors, which are complex and intertwined with the key political movements of Jewish life in the 20th century, namely socialism and Zionism, and questions around gender. I think I grew up with the idea that cantorate was an all-male profession, even as that was, of course, undergoing a radical transformation during the same period. But I came to understand that women were involved in making cantorial music in the early 20th century as well, during this kind of quote-unquote golden age.
Let's backtrack, because I'd love to have you tell me a little bit about your scholarly trajectory, especially given that you've shared now that you went back to school, and that this wasn't your first career path. When you decided on your initial research topic, why did you feel it was the right one for you?
I would say it found me. My initial research topic was going to be an archival project around the education of cantors before the establishment of the seminary schools. So the contemporary or later 20th century concept of cantorial education is very much focused on institutions in the United States. I'm talking about those institutions are very recent. Right? They were all formed post-World War II. So I wanted to learn, and I still want to learn more, about how cantors were trained before that. And it's a very difficult subject to research. But I was interested in trying, and I started studying Yiddish more seriously. The thought that I would be doing archival research and that skill has done me a lot of benefit, but not necessarily for the reason that I thought. So I started listening to the music of contemporary singers in the Hasidic community, who I refer to as cantorial revivalists, people for whom they're not necessarily coming from cantorial lineages, although some are. But the typical story is more about discovering old cantorial music as an art music genre that is uniquely accessible to someone with a religious knowledge base, but that is distinct from the rules of religion, especially the particular cultural rules of separatist orthodoxy. And for young men singers coming from this scene, there's a possibility in this music to become a different kind of person, right? To become a performer, an artist, to become someone who has their own kind of special spiritual authority, which is distinct and in some ways free from the very overdetermined forms of authority that rule in their community.
Would you say that graduate school had any particular bearing on your method or choice of topic to study? And likewise, is there particular advice that you would offer to prospective students or new scholars who are thinking about pursuing research into Golden Age Chazanis or the Cantorial Revival or any of these subject matters that you know so well?
There's a lot of work to be done on the archival material, and I think especially for scholars working in Europe, there are new archives that have opened up in the former Soviet Union and former communist bloc countries. And there are some scholars who are doing work with this material, but it's an area where there's a lot more to be done, especially around the careers of cantors and Jewish musicians in the early Soviet Union, which I feel is a very interesting and very under-researched area. And there are a lot of unanswered questions about how the ideas about what is tradition were founded. And a lot of the artists who were establishing what we think of as being the traditional cantorial sound were born in the Pale of Settlement, and some were active in the early Soviet era during this kind of fairly brief period when Yiddish culture was sponsored by the Soviet government. So people who have Russian, have Polish, and are interested in this topic would make a very nice contribution. I would like at some point to convene some kind of an international group of scholars to work on this subject. At the moment, I'm developing a research project and book project on early 20th century cantorial music, which is going to be heavily focused on the United States. I mean, it's a transnational music scene. So inevitably, if you're writing about Yiddish culture in New York in the early 20th century, you're also writing about Warsaw and Riga and Palestine. They're all very deeply connected. But because of my orientation as an Americanist and a Yiddishist, I'm more focused on
American
the American
story.
story.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you actually have your first book coming out very soon.
Yes, it's out
It's
already.
out already.
Yeah.
So I was going to say it would be out by the time this podcast episode was released, but we're already there. That's
Yeah.
awesome. And what is your book called, and what is it about for listeners who might now like to go check it out?
The book is called Golden Ages, Hasidic Singers and Cantorial Revival in the Digital Era. And it tells the story of young singers in the Hasidic community who have turned to the archive to do something kind of radical, to look in the history of Jewish expressive culture for an example of a new kind of person in the world, a liturgical artist, a musical expert who transforms the experience of prayer from a place of conservative boundary maintenance and turns it into a means for a radical expression of the self and of interiority and of transformed conceptions of what the past sounded like.
Who are some of the artists that these cantors of the contemporary period are listening to? And then in turn, who are some of the contemporary cantors that your book features?
Sure. Well, there's a very clear pantheon of cantors who are considered to be the greats. And that selection was made, of course, in the original era of the release of the gramophones by whom had record deals, and perhaps even more so by the anthologists who released reissue albums in the 50s and 60s. I'm thinking of like Benedict Stengler, the Collectors Guild, and the Great Old Recording Company. So these record labels put out reissues and kept in print the works of Zabel Kvartan, Pierre Pinchik, Yasla Rosenblatt, and Mordechai Hirschman, and a handful of others. And all told, it's a fairly small number of artists who we know a lot about their music. But there's, in addition to the dozen or so universally acknowledged masters, there's another several dozen who were also great, great artists and made a lot of records. And then, in addition to them, there's another several dozen whose work is more sparse in terms of its documentation, but they have a record here, they have a record there, and there are sort of stories or legends around their careers that are so that once you get to the post-war generation, you have artists like Moshe Beltshoff. You know, he's able to look at the tradition as having a lot of different stylistic elements, and that conception of there being heterogeneity within the corpus is very important.
And who are some of the artists that are now reviving this music?
The best known are Yanky Lemmer, Shemi Miller, Yoel Cohn, Motti Boyer, who I did not write about in my book, but who's working in Israel and who's developing his music in really beautiful and interesting directions. And there's maybe about a dozen artists. It is transnational. My research focused on the New York scene, but it's lived in different countries. The Hasidic scene doesn't have a single site, like Brooklyn, Antwerp, and Israel, and
How are you feeling about the new book?
Well, I'm grateful to have had the opportunity to finish it and to have it be out in the world. And I'm interested to see what people think about it. And I also want to write the addenda now. I mean, I'm working on a few articles currently that are geared towards fixing it, right? Because I wrote the book with a few ideas in mind about what was going to be important about it. One was that it would tell the story of these artists in a celebratory manner that would, in addition to offering analysis, it would shed light. It would introduce the singers to the world. And so that's very important to me. And I have an involvement, an activist approach towards their work, and I'm trying to do various things, produce records, produce concerts, help them write new music, which is very rewarding and important to me. On the other hand, my goal to draw positive attention to the artists, I think to some extent led me to try to go very gentle on issues around power and authority in the Hasidic community and the harm that is done to people, including ontological damage in terms of the ability of people to think about the possibilities of what their music can mean and what they can do with their work and their talent as a result of fear of being castigated for being a nonconformist. There are issues around the ethics of ethnography and what limits you place on yourself in order to do no harm. For artists and for people who are doing exploratory aesthetic work, there are a lot of challenges. And I don't go into that in as much depth as I think I might like to in the future. And then the other issue is gender, which I present the scene as being all male, which it is. That's not false. But there are also women artists in the Hasidic scene who are doing parallel work and also singing cantorial music. And that's sort of something that I'm finding more now after I've been doing this for a lot of years and know more people. So I'm working on a paper that will explore those themes.
Great, that's awesome. And there's the Chazanta story that you've also had an important role in trying to tell.
Yes, to me, that's one of the kind of really sad stories about Jewish American music. So there's this cohort of great women cantors working between 1920s and 60s who are not completely forgotten, but they're not part of the Golden Age canon, and for reasons having to do with sexism pretty blatantly. But sadly or oddly, surprisingly, there's a provocation in the fact that the female-led cantorate of the post-1970s, post-1980s period have not taken hold of these artists either as, talisman or as actual musical inspiration. And I think that's going to change as people hear about it more.
Yeah, good. What would you say are some new questions regarding research or subjects that are currently preoccupying you? What directions do you see yourself exploring next?
Well, I'm very deep in my second book project, which is about the period that the Cantorial Revivalists are exploring with their music. And I'm trying to see it as kind of the prehistory of this movement, this anti-conformist, this ambivalent about institutions, this purposefully transforming tradition in order to create a substance that can be called tradition. There's a lot that's going on in this era that has basically been ignored, right? The history of cantorial music has been largely a parochial one, and it's highly romanticized and not given critical inquiry for the most part. And that's a disservice to the complexity and depth of the music and the artists who are making it.
Right. But you'll be part of helping to remedy. So that's great.
That's my current goal. And then, you know, I'm working on different musical projects. At the moment, I'm trying to finish things. Right? This is a project that I've been working on for a lot of years. And I was sort of trying to do it while I was writing the other book as well. And I hope in the next year or so have a finished manuscript of the second book.
Very exciting. I look forward to reading it. Who would you say have been some of your biggest mentors or advocates or role models throughout your journey? You've mentioned a musical role model and partner in music making from early on in your story, but I wondered if there were academic mentors that you'd like to shout out as well.
Well, I certainly wouldn't have embarked on the academic path without Ari Kalman, who was my advisor and really believed in my work and, you know, without any particular evidence, believed in that it would be possible for me to become an academic, you know. So that was a major transformation in life for me. It was getting to work with him and learn about his approach to American Jewish culture, which has been hugely influential at Stanford. You know, I was also fortunate to work with Anna Schultz, you know, who's a major inspiration in terms of thinking about music and nationalism. And in terms of the hidden work that spiritual music traditions do in terms of creating political and social formations that are not visible on the first glance. And so her graduate seminars were a major source of inspiration and a place where I was fleshing out and working through ideas.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it. Are there particular methodological models or tools that you find yourself often using? And how did you develop an appreciation for those approaches?
My key methodologies are archival research and ethnography, and they're rather intertwined for me, I would say. I believe in trying to make the archive speak and in critical confabulation, you know, trying to find the stories that are at the margins and thinking about why they are marginalized and how they can be recentered and how to create poetry from the stories. Mm-hmm. And those are important things for me. And ethnography, I think, it's more transparent how that's the case. But then also, you know, you can read your ethnography archivally as well, right? And try to historicize the experiences of life. So they're complementary approaches.
Mm-hmm. Well, how would you say that you understand the field of Jewish music and your place in it? What issues or challenges with this field of study do you think scholars today need to remain attentive to?
I think it's challenging. You need to both look globally and at the same time really micro, right? And so the most interesting stories come from attention to overlooked details. Mm-hmm. And then also to trying to tend to what do people believe to be the truth.
Yeah.
And that's rather important because on the one hand, of course, you want to push back against received wisdoms, but at the same time, you ignore folk epistemologies at your peril, right? So you need to be in dialogue with what everybody says is true is going to have to, in some way, be your interlocutor. You know? Mm-hmm. So the field of Jewish music is, I think, trying to not get lost in telling the same story over and over again, not to be overly preoccupied with trying to find what is or is not Jewish, but look rather at practices and how people used the materials at hand, and to be in dialogue with the other people who are working. I mean, I think that, you know, parochialism is still a problem. Mm-hmm. And people getting lost in small stories without
thinking of
how they connect.
Yeah, the larger consequences.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is such a thing as Jewish music or an identifiable Jewish sound? Why or why not? If so, how would you characterize it? And if this question seems too essentializing, what questions about the music and sound of Jewish experience would you ask instead?
No, I don't think that it's a bad question. I think it's more like, what do Jews sound like? Mm-hmm. Is the more, and there's a lot of evidence, you know, recorded evidence. And I'm more interested in recorded sound than written texts. Mm-hmm. I feel that as a form of cultural pedagogy, listening to old records is quite key, right, to engendering a sense of what the music means and what it is. And it's not just about defining with words, but kind of getting a tactile, embodied sense for what the music feels like.
Fühl mich ist Moskau jetzt eine Festung, das harte Klima, die Unkenntnis, die Sprache, Reichsanwesenheit und Asia sehr eingeschränkte Lebensweise sind ebenso viele Bastionen.
kind of dialectic of absurdly over-determined stereotype and, on the one hand, cultural intimacy of like what makes people feel that they belong to a community. So there's a lot of slippage between those two things, right? And it's just kind of to be alive to the dynamics of falsehood and truth in artistic expression.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Jeremiah.
Thank you so much.
And now, a brief note from our sponsors. The Sounding Jewish podcast is grateful to be sponsored by the Herbert D. Katz Center for Advanced Judaic Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. This year, in honor of its fellowship theme, The Sound and Music of Jewish Life, many of the Katz Center's public programs, both online and in person, feature scholarship devoted to Jewish music and sound. On April 4th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Zoom, join the Jewish Music Forum and YIVO for a lecture by Dr. Amanda Rupenthal-Stein called Yudin, Baptized and Unbaptized, Jewishness and Ferdinand Hiller's Israel's Ziegesang. From April 15th to 16th, all academics are invited to join this year's Katz Fellows for our year-end conference, In Search of Jews, Music, and Sound, Lost, Hidden, Revived. Please register online using the links in the show notes. Thanks very much. Thanks for listening to the Sounding Jewish Podcast. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, the American Society for Jewish Music, the Milken Center for Music of American Jewish Experience at UCLA, and the University of Pennsylvania's Herbert D. Katz Center for Advanced Judaic Studies. Tune in next month when I will be joined by Dr. Rebecca Sipes to discuss her ongoing study of music in the Jewish cultures of Gregorian England, Enlightenment Berlin, and early modern Italy. Bye for now.